Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone, from for wherever you're joining from, and welcome to today's Awaken Call. Special guest speaker today is Otto Scharmer, and he's a professor, author, and founder of Wellbeing, Global Wellbeing and Gross National Happiness Lab. And talking to him today will be Somik Raha, who is who works at SmartOrg, and his passion is conducting research on value-based decision-making and helping organizations align their decisions with their core values. So I would like to hand over to Somik, who will be our moderator today. And Somik, maybe you want to introduce our guest and take it from there.
Yes. Hello, everyone. This is Somik. And our guest today is an absolutely fascinating person. And I have been reading Otto's writings. So we have a formal introduction on our website, and I'm not going to read that very much, apart from telling you that he's a professor at MIT, and he has two best-selling books called Theory U and Presence. And there's another one that's out. It's called Leading from the Emerging Future. And a lot of these books are on his website, and you can download excerpts from it. And they're absolutely fascinating. He also writes for the Huffington Post, and he runs an online course. These courses are called MOOCs. These are massively open online courses, which are free and available to anyone who wants to participate. And he's also launched a thing called the U Lab, which is a self-organizing platform with innovators. And the scale at which we're referring to this is staggering. I'm talking about 27,000 innovators from 191 countries. So he's doing a lot of interesting work. And what, you know, I just want to start by sharing three things that stood out for me as I was reading through what he's written. And one of them was about getting beyond the duality of mindless action and actionless mind. And that I thought was extremely profound for me because, you know, on the one hand, we get intellectual and we don't do anything, so we don't learn anything. On the other hand, we jump in to do stuff and we create more trouble in the universe. And so how do we get beyond that? And Otto's work seems to be in the space of transcending this duality. The second thing that came up for me was this idea of presencing that he talks about, where, you know, as innovators or as people who want to make a change, instead of leading from the mind, he talks about surrendering in a very deep sort of way. And he has this wonderful, beautiful graphic. Since this is not, we don't really have a visual, I'm going to try to describe it. So some of our listeners may be familiar with the famous crossing the chasm, which basically describes how innovation happens or really goes in phases. And his graphic is about crossing the threshold and stepping into the field of the future. And there's this picture of a person who is on a cliff and he or she wants to jump over to a much higher position, but that seems to be an apparent superficial level. The real work is depicted in the graphic as instead of jumping up, it's about going deep inside. And I'll just read a few of the words. It'll give you a flavor of his work. So it starts with downloading past patterns, suspending, and then seeing with fresh eyes, redirecting the energy and sensing from the field of the future, letting go, presencing. Presencing is a very interesting word he has coined. I'm sure he'll talk about this. Connecting to your source, and then the opposite of letting go, which is letting come. And then crystallizing vision and intention, enacting, prototyping by linking head, heart, hand, embodying, and then finally reaching the new peak, a higher peak, which is performing by operating from the whole. These are very different words, and words have their own vibrations around this, you know, around where they can take us. So this is the second big thing that stood out for me. And the third thing, he talks about having an open mind, an open heart, and an open will. I'm familiar with the first two, but this is the first time I heard of an open will. And I thought that was extremely fascinating as well. And so I want to begin the conversation. So I'll start by first situating a little bit of where he's coming from in academia. And this I feel is important to give a little context. So I had the good luck to talk to him before this call began. So I was asking him that how do you manage to do this kind of work in academia? Because in academia, you have to ground yourself in a particular intellectual tradition. And most of the traditions out there are pretty restrictive for an open inquiry into the spirit. And many academic institutions don't even tolerate such inquiry. And so he was clarifying to me that he comes from the tradition called action research, where, and he said something very profound, that you can only understand a system by changing it. And that to me was a very profound idea, and that's at the heart of action research. And for those of you who might have read anything around Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank, I think it's good to tell you that Muhammad Yunus basically used action research in a very powerful way. That was his methodology that allowed him to connect to the academic side of his work. And it also got his work a lot more acceptance. The rigor came from diligently following action research. So with that, I'm going to start with some questions for Otto. So, and by the way, talking about ecosystem to ecosystem, these questions actually came from our ecosystem. We let people know a little bit about Otto and ask them what questions came up for them. So the first one is this. So Otto, we're told that you grew up on a farm, and looking back, how did that experience impact the values that you currently cherish?
Well, thank you very much, Somik, for the introduction and for having me at this call, and hello to everyone. And maybe just as a disclaimer, not everything that you said actually, it sounds a lot more grandiose than it really is if you look at it by daylight. So, and also, I thought, Somik, you did like a summary much better than I could have done. So, some of the key ideas or concepts that I have been trying to hone and to bring into the world. And maybe just in answering your question, so what I can add to the conversation probably is a little bit kind of sharing of the context and so on. And in fact, it's interesting that you start with that question, Somik, because I'm calling in actually exactly from that place. Kind of, it's a small farm in northern Germany in Europe. So I'm just visiting Europe and will be returning to the States only in a few days. And I'm actually speaking to you all kind of from the place where I grew up in. And it's a farm that my parents, some 55, almost 60 years ago, switched from conventional agriculture to organic agriculture. So some of you may know the biodynamic strand of organic, which is basically organic plus maybe a more a spiritual worldview underneath. And that definitely shaped my own thinking or being in many ways. I'm sure many ways that I'm not even aware of. But what I am aware of course, is what you pick up kind of on a farm that's run in this way is one, kind of everything is connected with each other, and there is kind of this living ecosystem, kind of that all beings, all animals, plants, including the human being, together form a whole, and that kind of each place and each farm has its own way of being and its own interiority. So that kind of, that kind of perception of kind of what's visible, what's not, and kind of the appreciation for all of these dimensions. That's certainly something I picked up on. And then on this farm, there were always many young people coming in from a variety of places and countries in order to learn this way of operating. So we as a family turned our the ownership of the farm into a foundation in order to allow also other members to join the farming community. So, and it's now operated as a cooperative with not as it used to be like a century ago or 70 years ago with kind of one family owning anything and the whole place and everyone else working for them, but more kind of a cooperative structure. And then, of course, today, organic farms much more really embedded in their environment. So why it used to be like a fairly isolated place when I grew up in terms of their direct neighbor relationships, now it's really almost like there's constantly kind of an inflow and outflow from the environment. So I guess what influenced me is one kind of this that the echo and the social and the spiritual somehow, one way or another, are things related to each other. And the other aspect, of course, watching my parents, following this idea of a different type of agriculture in an environment which was totally conventional, and all the failures and, negative feedback being ostracized by the environment, basically swimming against the stream as any kind of innovator does, and kind of all the isolation, struggles, loneliness, and setbacks that come with that. We saw a lot of that before, later on, many years later, it started to work somewhat on a different level. So appreciation for this swimming against the stream and following your own idea, that's certainly another thing that that deeply impacted me growing up in this place.
So you mentioned, and since the topic of our call today is going from the ecosystem to the ecosystem, you start your book reflecting on the word echo itself. Could you share some more about that? What is the root of this word, echo, and also ego?
Yes. So ecology and, ecosystem is a word that really, and also economy kind of goes back to the Greek root oikos, which is the house, which is kind of the larger house of being we are living in. And so in the original meaning, economy kind of, in the sense of the Greek oikos, what was really kind of the geared towards the well-being of the whole house, while then kind of later on in economics, it was much more about, creating wealth and kind of more narrowing on the so-called economic and financial aspects. But that happened later on. So ecosystem is, as opposed to usually in systems thinking, it's just kind of the connections among a number of elements. But ecosystem is kind of also the environment, so the enabling environment. So the and what I found interesting, so when I went to from Germany to MIT in order to really learn more this action research, because at German universities back then I couldn't find this action research. It was just kind of observing, thinking, publishing. It was not, and I really, some 20 years ago when, I had my PhD more or less done, I realized that I could, like a good European intellectual, talk about just everything, but that my knowledge was pretty much useless for the people in the field who actually tried to create the changes that I was talking about and interested in. So this quest for how to develop a knowledge that's actually helpful for the very people that I'm interested in and that I try to be in support of, that brought me to MIT. And then at MIT, kind of there was this organization learning center and systems thinking center. So that brought me into the systems thinking and the term, and you know, then you know, I got more involved in the action research, action learning, participated in a lot of projects, and so on. And basically, what I noticed is that you know, in most systems today. So when you know, for example, deal with the reinvention of schools and learning of health, you know, around hospitals and so on and so forth, it is impossible to change the system or to deal with the key leadership challenge just when you only work with one company or one organization or one institution. Because in all these big societal challenges that we face today, we basically have the same situation that in order to address the real issues, we need to bring together all the different stakeholders in the system, including business, including civil society, including government, and then we need to move them from through a process that moves from ego system awareness, by which I mean kind of, you know, basically seeing the problem, seeing the situation only from your own institutional angle, only from your own kind of silo perspective, to something that I started calling ecosystem awareness or ecosystem awareness, by which I mean an awareness that is not only interested in my own well-being, but that's really driven by wanting to serve the well-being of all, including the well-being of the planet. And that's the interesting thing is, while usually we talk about that as a moral imperative, right, something that we think should happening, if you look at, you know, the real issues in education and health and business and government today, it also is an economic imperative. So it's in order to address the key challenges that institutions face today, we need to develop these new areas of collaboration. And these areas of collaboration are only successful if the mindset, if the awareness, if the consciousness is shifting from ego to eco. So it's really interesting that kind of this shift from ego to eco that maybe in earlier times was more something coming from a moral or religious or kind of a spiritual perspective, now is a systemic imperative almost. It's an, you know, it's a requirement that the world, kind of the challenges that we face are calling us to do. And I think that's really interesting, kind of that we really in our time deal with these two forces, kind of the new requirements that what the world is calling us to do from the outside, and then the deeply held inner aspiration or need or hunger for a deeper level of awareness. And, you know, when these two forces meet, I think mountains can shift, or kind of as you put it in your introduction, that's kind of where the magic or the shift of awareness is happening. And then a lot of things are possible.
Several things come up for me when hearing this. And I think the first thing, it seems to me that the theme you're reflecting on is that people have to transform from within. So I want to let our listeners know that Otto's PhD dissertation was in fact titled Transforming Capitalism as a Revolution from Within. And which year was this, by the way?
That was in 1994.
So this is fascinating. And then the other thing that came up for me was it's quite normal for me to hear people criticize those who come from an ego-centric awareness and kind of judge or condemn them. And that I've seen doesn't really produce any kind of action, because those who have this kind of awareness, they close their ears and they don't do anything. But it seems to me what you're describing, after some of the other research papers that you published, you seem to be able to connect it back to their aspirations. So I think I read somewhere you wrote that if you want to innovate, then you are necessarily listening to the future that hasn't come about yet. And so you do have to master this ability to go within, sense the future, and sort of birth it in a way without getting in the way. That's pretty remarkable. Yeah. Can you say more about this?
Well, I mean, so that's really the other main insight. Kind of when I got so when I went to Boston and got more involved into the practical work, what I realized is, so in the field of organizational learning, where I basically have spent kind of the better part of the past 20 years or so, what I quickly realized is this, that on the one hand, when you look into the methods, tools, and organizational learning theories, and, you know, consulting companies do, the best practices, and what's written in the great books and methods, it's all based on the same learning model. And what they mean by learning in organizational learning is basically learning by reflecting on the experiences of the past. So you could also say learning by kind of reflecting back on the past. And that's kind of the backbone. It's very valuable. And yet, what I realized in working with teams on a grassroots level in, business organizations and also in governments and NGO organizations, is that almost always, I mean, at least more often than not, leaders and leadership teams and communities face challenges of disruptive change. And what is disruptive change? It's a type of change where yesterday is not a good predictor for what's going to happen tomorrow. So where kind of we have some patterns are ending and you could say dying maybe, and something else is beginning and emerging. So these challenges where just reflecting on the past is not good enough, that's almost the rule now. It's not only for us as individuals, it's also on an organizational and on a team level. So the more I realize that, the more I am. So the following question crystallized in my mind, which is there a second source of learning? A source of learning that's not only operating by reflecting on the experience of the past, but one that allows us to sense and connect with emerging future possibilities and then to operate from that connection, from that awareness and that connection. So, and that's where, this word that you mentioned in your introduction, presencing, which doesn't really exist kind of in dictionaries or so, which is basically a blend between two words. It's sensing and presence. So presencing means sensing and actualizing an emerging future possibility, or sensing and actualizing your highest future possibility. And the gateway for that, kind of for the sensing, is connecting with your emerging self. So it's or your capital S self. And so I really became interested in, and it wasn't just like an academic pursuit, because I talked with many innovators. I talked with social innovators, but also in technology, in academia, artists, and so on. And when you talk to people who really created something new, you realize these people operate in a way that's not just reflecting on the past. They access a different source of knowing, a different source of intelligence, which is not just the mind, but which has to do with your heart, which has to do with kind of with the capacity to sense certain opportunities, and, which maybe has to do with, open will really means kind of the capacity to let go and let come. It's you know, for example, the courage to step into the unknown, something, pursue something that you can feel, but you can't have certainty around. And so I became interested in, so does that second source of learning, kind of sensing and actualizing the highest future possibility, does that exist? And if yes, how does it work? And to cut a long story short, I think the what resulted from that quest is it's basically a process which goes through three main movements. And the first one is observe, observe, observe. And it really means to go to the edges of the system, to go to the periphery. For example, when we did like a health, reinventing health project in Namibia, in Africa, and how do you understand the system? By walking in the shoes of the most remote, patients, kind of, in this case, it was mothers, in the system with very little, if any, access to clinics and so on. So experiencing the system from the margin, from walking in the shoes of the most marginalized members or stakeholders in that system, that's kind of number one, kind of really getting out of your own bubble and making the different players see the system through each other's perspective, particularly the most through the eyes of the most marginalized. Secondly, retreat and reflect, allow the inner knowing to emerge. So as then kind of you begin to synthesize all these experiences and make sense kind of from all these sensing activities that went on maybe over a couple of weeks or so, you not only try to listen to everything that has been learned, but you really try to connect that and to listen to that from a deeper place that's asking, what is it really that's wanting to happen here, and how does that relate to our journey kind of as change makers, to what we feel could be the emerging future that we want to contribute to, that we want to be part of. And then, when kind of from this process a number of ideas are generated, then the third stage is kind of the prototyping, which is really what you alluded to with linking head, heart, and hand, and moving away from the duality of mind is action and action is mind towards really learning by doing, kind of acting from the now, exploring new ideas by doing something very small, very quickly, and kind of really cultivating the capacity of acting and generating from the now and kind of receiving the feedback for others from others who participate in that, and then iterate what you are trying to do. So these are like three process elements that we then started cultivating, kind of co-sensing, going to the edges of the system, the deep reflection with all the contemplative practices related to that, and then kind of basically the learning by doing. And as we tried to then explore these methods with in different systems, we learned that this process really only works if the individuals in that process do some inner cultivation work. And that inner cultivation work we summarized with the words open mind, open heart, open will. An open mind basically means seeing with fresh eyes, as you mentioned. An open heart basically means accessing, seeing the situation through the eyes of another, kind of accessing your own empathy, kind of your own compassion. An open will basically is about the capacity of letting go and letting come that you so nicely demonstrated with your airport story, right? So when you gave up, you surrendered, and from that giving up and surrendering, kind of a space of possibility is emerging. Kind of that's kind of the letting go and letting come, and that's, of course, when you deal with communities where people are in conflict with each other and so on, have a lot of bad, you know, not bad, a lot of old karma and, you know, experiences that need to be worked through and so on. That's, of course, hard, right? But yet, kind of, that's where the support and the help is and the attention is needed.
Well, so is this what you just described so far? Is this a summary of Theory U?
Yeah. That's basically, you know, Theory U is really two things. It's a framework and a method, a process, kind of. And the framework part really looks at the development of individuals, teams, organizations, and societies from a consciousness-based point of view. So kind of looking at different stages of that development, how communication develops, how our capacity of listening is developing, according kind of to, you know, how our level of operating, so whether we, for example, move from ego system awareness and are able to move to an ecosystem awareness. So it's basically a framework that looks at social systems and the evolution of social systems from the viewpoint of an evolving consciousness. And so that's the first thing, kind of this framework. And the second aspect, what Theory U is really the process, kind of a method so that it gives it's kind of the answering. It gives a set of methods and tools that helps change makers to basically move from ego to eco, you could say. But you could also say in a more precise way to, you know, help oneself and others in a system to open the mind, the heart, and really to operate from this deepened opening process.
This is fascinating. And many strands of thoughts are getting connected, and one conclusion I'm realizing, and you mentioned this before our call began, was so I'd asked Otto what makes this research valid, and he had said that the yardstick of validity for different streams of knowledge is quite different, and for instance, in if you're in the social sciences, the yardstick of validity is, are you describing other people in a way that they would agree with it? And so what was his? And he had then said that if you can help people change or transform, and the transformation actually happens, that in action research is the source of validity. And it kind of really, I feel like it nails it in the direction that he's been describing. Indeed, this rings true. And perhaps the ancient sages were action researchers because the methods they described, we only accept it when it works in our context and it actually changes us. So it's very interesting that, you know, this is in academia we often consider as a little removed from practical reality, and yet Otto seems to have tapped into something that's intensely practical. So I want to move to another
question. Can I say something? I think that's really very true, and So I just want to add like kind of two pieces of reality here. Number one is, so in academia, right? So I feel and I consider myself like a failed academic, right? So it's I think that's a quite accurate description, because as an action researcher, I did not go down the conventional path of kind of tenure-track faculty, which would have required me to do a lot of more quantitative kind of in shorter-term activities, and which basically deliver against kind of the standards of an old paradigm that I believe is going out of the window, or should be going out of the window. So, but it means, like, if you have that personal choice, it means basically in the eyes of the old system, you're a failure. I mean, you're changing your audience, right, from kind of maybe your colleagues and people who read academic papers to more the world, right, the people of change makers in the world who actually use the stuff, use the social technologies that you develop. So that all sounds good, but, you know, it doesn't always feel good. So that's, you know, sometimes you're alone in that and so on. That's one part. And I remember a moment, kind of, that must have been 10 years ago, and maybe some of your, some of the people kind of being part of this conversation now participated in that. It was the first time that His Holiness the Dalai Lama came to came to MIT for a public event. And that was a dialogue between mindfulness practitioners on the one hand and cognition researchers and brain scientists on the other hand. And it was conducted by the Mind and Life Institute. And it was just fascinating because it really was, the third-person view, kind of the scientist, the brain scientist, and then the first-person view, these incredibly accomplished kind of mindfulness practitioners that started to have this dialogue. And when I, so I was so inspired by that, and it really kind of changed me in a quite, inspired and, moved me on a quite subtle and yet tangible way. And I don't know whether you know this, but sometimes, there are these moments when I was walking after these, it was a 1.5 day event, when I was walking out of that hall, I knew there was a moment of total clarity. I knew exactly what I was meant to do in this lifetime. And the clarity was this, that because the entire, and then of course after that you lose it, right? But so there was this moment. And then it was the entire 1.5 days were really an inquiry between two things, which is, you could say, science and consciousness, or science and spirituality. And what I felt was missing was the third part of this triangle, which is not only science and spirituality, but also profound social change. So, and what resulted from that is kind of me with some colleagues creating a group. We call it the S3 group, kind of science, spirituality, and social change, because I believe that kind of the real need, and also kind of that's and the real contribution that's needed by the crisis in the world, and kind of the moment of disruption we are all living in, has to do with linking kind of the dimension of consciousness and the dimension of science with putting it into the service of helping kind of this social, the collective social systems that we collectively enact to evolve and to function on a higher level of awareness and consciousness. So that's really, in a nutshell, what I try to do, to create places and to really focus on where these three angles can come together. Because, and that's why I leave, I believe that many of the people participating in this conversation, are actually change makers, kind of in communities and in organizations and on a grassroots level. And I think what we, all of us who are kind of involved in the practice of this change, we have a very privileged window in such an interesting aspect of how the world is evolving, which has to do with the evolution and the shift in the social field, that people who are stuck in academia and who have all the research tools available are so remote from it, which is exactly why they usually come up with boring things. So in other words, us kind of who are the practitioners of creating shifts in social fields, shifting the level of awareness and consciousness in social fields, whether you call it ego to eco or other ways, doesn't matter. But we all know that there are these moments where that shift happened, as you demonstrated with your AirPod story. We have a particular access to where evolution takes place. And what I try to do is to illuminate that invisible dimension of social change a lot more. And in fact, only now, I told you, it took me 10 years. I had this moment, and then you lose it, and you have it as an aspiration. But some of you, maybe we can share it in the follow-up, this we are actually going to conduct a week-long action research, awareness-based action research conference in Vermont the last week of August. You find that on the Mind and Life Institute website, and you know, maybe we can put in the follow-on, the transcript of this conversation, the link, a conference that brings together researchers and change makers in social systems that operate from an awareness-based view. And the idea is to form teams to really and to launch this whole research field of how social fields are shifting and, you know, what the role of consciousness is in shifting social fields. It's much needed and it's much practiced today in the world, but little understood. And if we can shed some light into that, I think that could be a great contribution. And just by talking about this now, I realize how that links me, how that activity this year actually has its roots in this experience 10 years ago when I walked out of the, you know, session there and had this brief moment of total clarity. So that's really at the heart of what I try to do. And, you know, many of the people who are part of this conversation would be happy to join that conversation. So we should be sharing the link.
So you've answered several of our questions, actually. You know, we had one question from Parth Savla, who asked if you ever hit a low point in your life and what kept you grounded. And you've kind of, with the Dalai Lama story, you kind of shared that. And another question we had here was, who were your heroes of social change? And so you mentioned the Dalai Lama. Is there anyone else you'd like to mention?
Well, I mean, I have been always inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, of course. So I had the opportunity must have been some 1990 actually, to spend, it was only a few weeks in India, Gujarat, Vidyapeeth, and some other places. And so I think he has some interesting things about, you know, the economy that are largely ignored. So this whole approach of kind of using your inner state of being as leverage point in kind of positive societal transformation that is transforming bad structures, but is not directed against kind of bad people, quote unquote, but that is kind of partnering, really trying to address kind of the emerging or the higher self in others around us. That has been a big inspiration to me, and it's it's still guiding me. That's a very important source of inspiration to me. Another one, it's kind of the 20th century avant-garde artist Joseph Beuys. So he is he operated out of Germany, and so he had this concept of social sculptures. So his idea was that every single human being is an artist, is a creator, and that the most important art form of our time is actually the social sculpture, which is the sum total of all social relationships that we collectively enact. And so thinking about our social systems more from a sculptural or aesthetic point of view has been also a big source of what's inspiring me, because theory U basically describing different layers of the social field. On the one end of the spectrum with mind and matter totally separate and, you know, basically downloading and, you know, the connection to source totally lost. And on the other end of the spectrum, the presencing really operating from connecting with the deeper sources of being, kind of connecting with operating from source or from true presence. That's something that greatly shaped my own thinking. So this whole notion of the social field and that kind of it's the social fields that we collectively enact that we need, which in many ways are our blind spot because we don't see them, and yet kind of that's where the real change is happening. That has been also very influential to me.
Okay. We are quickly getting to the point where we'll open it up for others. So very quickly, I wanted to get in some more questions. So you kind of bringing all of this these experiences and these ideas and turning them into these experiences, these grand experiences through your MOOCs at MIT. And from what I gather, your most recent course had 28,000 students online. And so can you briefly share what were some of the key lessons that you learned from doing this?
Well, yeah, so it is a really interesting, sorry, just to get the numbers right, it is correct. There were 28,000 students registered, but in a MOOC, and as you mentioned at the outset, MOOC is an acronym for Massive Open Online Course, and it's existing for the past 2.5 years or so. It's a movement from a few universities, MIT is among them, to really make all educational content accessible for free to everyone, or to everyone kind of who has access to a computer. So it's a massive move towards democratizing the access to education, which is wonderful. So it's great. And it's a huge problem also because, of course, in the end, if education is moving into everyone just sitting in front of their own computer, it's like, you know, the end of real education, you could say, the end of deep learning. And so mostly MOOCs are applied to just transfer of technical knowledge, very, you know, the deeper learning cycles and, you know, I mean, and then kind of the deeper leadership and transformative learning, let alone kind of sources of spirituality. And so not at all. And what we did in this experiment is, so I got the possibility to turn my course that I teach at MIT to a MOOC, and we tried to link kind of the positive side of this massive open online learning with mindfulness practices, local action learning, with live sessions where we bring people together around the world in real time, with small group coaching circles where in a very deep and personal way kind of they apply kind of deep listening, which is with your mind and heart wide open, and then really talking about the biographical threshold kind of that you face in your work and in your life. We had no idea whether it would be working, right, on that level of scale. And also on, you know, mostly technology enabled. But we did suggest to people, hey, form local hubs, form your local group, and then kind of team up in small circles. So we basically tried to bring in the community dimension into online learning by, you know, creating blended or hybrid learning environments that in part are enabled through the MOOC from MIT, but mostly really are self-organized, right, by these communities. Mm-hmm. And what was so inspiring to see is not only the willingness from so many people to self-organize. We have people organize hubs in at least 300 different places around the world, in which they kind of followed the live sessions and did some other activities. But also kind of all the small coaching circles that formed probably 700 or 1,000 or so or more, we don't know for sure. And then also because we thought, well, you know, this deeper, really more spiritual dimension kind of where you connect with the sources of self and so on, that's really only for a few, and so many people really connected with that. It was really moving to see. And it tells you how huge the hunger is kind of for connecting with one another and with oneself on a much deeper level. So when we made the exit survey, keep in mind, it's just a five-week online course. I mean, that's near to nothing. 50% said that it was an eye-opening experience to them, and another 37% said it was a life-changing experience. So almost 90% of people reporting about either an eye-opening or a life-changing experience in an online course, it's just amazing. And it's only possible because the readiness in our communities to tap into this deeper space of awareness and of connecting with each other and with oneself is so available today, we are just not activating it. And that's a really, so it really is, we don't know really what happened there. We are just at the beginning of finding out. But one thing is for sure, which is that we live in a moment that's not only marked by, you know, big crisis, disruption, and all the negativity that we see every day in the newspaper, but also of an amazing opening where so many people are longing towards, but also moving to this deeper space of connecting with one another and with oneself and with one's, maybe purpose or journey that you feel being part of. And that's very uplifting, and it allows us to, you know, basically to organize around global movements in a completely new way.
It's amazing. It makes me want to take your course. So what I've heard is that, Otto, when you in your classes, you often introduce service space. And so I wanted to ask you, what about service space resonates most deeply with you?
Well, I mean, so let me make my admission up front. I actually know very little about service space, and that's exactly why I want to connect more, because, you know, from all the little experience I have had, I felt so much connection, and so that we are really walking on parallel paths and could, connect moving forward a lot more. So what I'm actually doing and what I have been doing for, a few years now is to show Nipun's TED Talk, and then, and then I have some other speakers. But so he is just coming in as, over that talk, and then, some other speakers around that. Because I think he is embodying, and I think a lot of what I now say applies to all of you and kind of to the whole movement that you guys represent. But in my eyes, it's kind of embodying kind of the meeting or the connection or the growing together of two very significant and powerful forces in the world, which is the power of entrepreneurship and the power of compassion, or the awakening intelligence of the heart. And you can see how these two things begin to grow together, in some cases as already fully embodied, and in other cases more like as an aspiration. But these are two very significant forces at the beginning of this century on the planet. And as they begin to move together, it's very, very important and significant. And so that's why I show these examples. And of course, I know how it connects with me, and I'm watching how it connects with all these students, anyone, like, we all do what we can in the place where life puts us. So in my case, I'm at MIT, so I use this institution to, I work with a variety of bunch. I work with Chinese government, very senior officials. I work in part with big old style companies. I work with a lot of, with grassroots, with NGOs. And and of course I'm coming, originally kind of from a movement, kind of from the green movement here in Europe, and the peace movement, that was instrumental also to bring down the wall in 1989. And so what I know, of course, is that and what I'm noticing is this, that although many people think, well, the real new only happens on a grassroots level, social entrepreneurship and kind of these small-scale, really radical experiments that are so important that we see, developing today, I also have the experience that many of the same aspirations, when you work with the younger leaders in the more traditional organizations, be that government, business, or otherwise, also NGO, these other people, they basically, they have the same aspirations. It's not different. And, in my class at MIT, I have all these mid-career executives that, their companies, they are like on the fast track, making a career in their company. They sent them for a year to MIT. They came to my class, and then in the beginning I asked them, so what brings you here? So why are you coming to this class? And then often the response is this: the higher I get in my organization, the less I am inspired. The more I am asked to do something that's completely disconnected from what I really want to do. So the window into the world that I happen to have puts me in front a lot of these things, kind of where I feel that we not only need to work on the grassroots level, but also pay attention where the cracks of possibility open up in the old system so that we can make connection between, these groups. Because, many people, not all of them, but many people in these systems have very similar aspirations. They didn't, maybe they didn't have the support, or they made some other choices, and so on. So that's something that I try to contribute to when I build these platforms of tri-sector collaboration, where leaders and change makers from the civil society world, from business and from government, are coming together and going on a journey, and in order to collaborate across boundaries more effectively.
Hmm. Thank you so much. That was really profound. Thanks so much for that question.
Hi, my name is Tom Malarkey, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. And thank you for your work, first of all, and what it's making possible. My question has to do with, in a methodology that is bringing people together, in what sounds like across many forms of difference, be it sector difference, racial difference, cultural difference, gender, et cetera. What are you learning about how to work across those differences? Because I get the fundamental connections that we have, especially when we are looking into future possibilities together. But in my work, which is in education reform, specifically equity-centered education reform, you can't go around those issues. You need to go through them. So I'm curious what you're learning and seeing.
I think at the beginning, what I learned is you always work with microcosms. So you never try to focus on the whole from the get-go. You try to be smaller and more nimble and start there where the opportunity for change is. And then when you really have the intention, when you clarify the intention and ask yourself, in order to change the system, so who are all the different players that need each other in order together change the system? That's often a very useful question to ask that allows you to bring together a very diverse group. And once kind of that's convened, you go on a journey with them. I did notice that kind of the more on average kind of the more marginalized, the more structural violence you have in the system. So I remember, I'm German, my background, and then the first in Namibia, the first workshop was where the Germans, right next to the place where the Germans committed the first Holocaust of the 20th century. And so you have many decades and centuries of structural violence going on. What that requires you to adapt from the process point of view is to basically give more support and more time and more environment to nurture, to some degree maybe heal, but to another degree is really to reconnect with your own confidence in creating the change that you want to be part of. So that's something that I learned there. And then as you move more towards the later stages of the process, there's always, some people who leave and some people who join. So in other words, what is the U process? The U process is basically you organize around something that's emerging. So by definition, you don't know exactly what the result will be. And therefore, you have also this change in group composition, because who you thought you would be the key partner in the beginning is not exactly what happens in the end. So there's then always this onboarding of new partners, of new communities that would join an initiative. And a lot so has to do with really holding the space. I mean, holding the space is probably the number one leadership capability that we need to cultivate when you look at these more complex processes. It's holding the space for those who come in, for those whose voice isn't usually heard. And what I found is if you go then on a journey together, that's so much more effective and transformative than hanging out in a workshop together or kind of having some reasonable conversation or so. Because when you go on a journey, when you really kind of immerse yourself into worlds that you don't know, that's where the opening of the mind and the heart happens so much more naturally. And that's where many of these boundaries that otherwise keep us separated are opening up or breaking down quite quite naturally. And so you're not trying to map the existing system necessarily. You try to, get a feel for what the emerging future could look like. What is that space of possibility? And then, so that you begin to organize around that. So it's not like kind of the big guys of the big institution that are so much anchored in their institutional ego that, you can just forget about that. It's more you more go to the practitioner, to the edges of the system for, the younger, the more at the periphery, because the future shows up never in the center first. The future shows up at the periphery first. That's why you go there for the learning journeys, the sensing activities, the observe, and that's also why when you create a group composition, you really want to bring kind of the viewpoints of the periphery, of the younger and more different people. You want to mix the diversity, because that's the only way to come up with something new.
Mm-hmm. That resonates. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love that. The future shows up at the periphery first. I'm going to the next caller.
Hi, this is Kozo from Cupertino. And as the father of two sons, Otto, thank you so much for ULAB, because I've given up on trying to save for their college education, so they'll be in your class in about 10 years. But I love this idea that you just ended with, where you experienced the system from the margins of the system. And I'm wondering, obviously you probably considered the digital divide when you constructed ULAB and the MOOC. And I'm seeing the digital divide is no longer racial, and it's economic, but it's not economic in terms of access. It's economic in terms of different types of knowledge. So I'm wondering if including the marginalized voices, if you're including different forms of knowledge that might not be first world, that might not be highly educated, that might be disenfranchised, for example, like prisoners or people who have very little skills in academics but have some great wisdom traditions.
Yes, that's certainly an aspiration. How much did we realize that in the first prototype? Some. We certainly had a good spread across, college, kind of formal education degrees, a full spread also in terms of the voices that came in from the interviewees and so on. We try to really bring in, traditional academia is, it's sort of deadening in many ways. So when you look at kind of the way we try to construct these learning environments, and for example, in the first week, we really try to activate and, engage the whole human being. For example, in the first week, or I think it was the second week, participants were asked to go on an empathy walk, right? So we went through kind of the deep listening practices and so on, and then we asked them, okay, now this week, practice deep listening with a person totally different to yourself. Kind of look for a stranger, kind of who holds very different views, is on the complete other side of, whatever you consider yourself on, and be a guest in that person's life, kind of really, connect on a deeper human level. And that's an example. This is kind of very, basically all academic, education, or what we call education, is socializing that capacity of these deeper listening skills out of you. And yet, for those people who actually work on a community level, with or without formal education, that's kind of the basic skill that you need in order to, in order to get anything done and in order to operate. So I think we have made some progress on what you indicated, but certainly there's ways to go. I mean, for example, on the prisoner side and so on, and it will take a while. So we have. Engaging, so it was interesting to see how much activity there was on a place-based way of organizing. And there was a bunch of participants, not a small number, who actually just participate in these place-based communities. They were not formally enrolled in the, all the basically digital support learning infrastructure. They just came to some of the live session and participated in that community. So that's the interesting thing. If you, this type of MOOC is a radical experiment really in self-organizing. And what you realize as a designer or like a faculty, quote unquote, for that is you have no control whatsoever, right? There's no way, in a traditional classroom, basically people more or less follow. In this environment, kind of, you just create the surface for people to develop their own initiatives. And really what our highest aspiration was to create a vehicle that people in local communities could take in order to activate their own local fields as change makers. And that, at least to some degree, I just heard that a few days ago here in Lisbon, who pretty much using the same words, and they said, so we did that. So we created kind of this kind of local engagement here with people that we didn't engage with before, and it was important that we did that as a part of a global community. So there is something, when you step back and say, okay, what is it really? So why is something like that working to some degree? I mean, not everything was working, but it did work to some degree. And I believe the main thing is that we are activating a social field. And what is the social field? It is global already, because the reality, I mean, the economy today is global. So it is a global ecosystem. It's just our mind that's wrapped around the ego. The reality is already eco. So it, to some degree, kind of our challenge is to open up the mind so it can catch up with reality. And people are fascinated just being part of this. You know, you have like guided mindfulness, little kind of moments of meditation in these global life sessions. That's where, and we have heard that from many, I could feel the global field. I could feel the alignment with the others. I could feel the connection, the heart-to-heart connection across the planet. I could feel kind of the body of the planet underneath. So there is a very tangible experience of that social field possible today. It's just we haven't really activated that. So that really was, to me, the most interesting. And it's interesting because it opens up an entire new avenue of, you know, usually people think, yeah, online, it's like, you know, many of these things you only can do in small groups on the ground. And then online is just kind of the stripped down version of other forms of learning. And with activating the global field, it actually opens up a whole new door that you wouldn't have otherwise. So you self-organize locally, you activate that community, and you're empowered. The source of empowerment is the global connection, doing that as part of a global community. And I think that's really cool because it gives us a whole other source of empowerment that previously, you know, we haven't used. It's used maybe by all the other guys, the Goldman Sachs and so on, but we haven't used it.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to point out that, like, I love that idea of the empathy walk, and I read that story about the student who sat down with two homeless people, and I guess what I'm dreaming of is homeless people would be part of the ULab classroom. They would be part of a hub. They would be included in that social field, that actual academic social field.
Mm-hmm. Very true. That's the goal.
Right.
Thank you. So we have a couple more questions.
Hi, this is Miss in New York City, and thank you, Otto, for giving of yourself today to us. In reading and preparation for today's call, I came upon something. I don't know if there's a true connection, but I wondered, Jacques Fresco's Venus Project, are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Okay, it's a theoretical economic system, redesigning cities to meet human needs. They describe it as a global resource-based economy to serve and protect the environment and, you know, a part of nature, not separate. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that or if it was feasible. It sounded good in theory, but I didn't know if it could be put into practice. So that was my question.
Well, I mean, that is, of course, the big question on the table, and we know that, you know, a lot of the solution towards, you know, making well-being and life and the economy more sustainable has to do with inner cities and reinventing cities and inner cities. You know, it's, you know, and it's a huge focus area, I think, where innovation takes place. And I'm very much interested in that also in early stages of projects, but I haven't really done a lot of work there myself, but certainly kind of some of the ideas that you mentioned are so spot on, and it's kind of the prime example where, you know, no one can create the changes, the innovations that we really need together. So we need each other, and we need kind of this new collaborative infrastructures. So I think that's exactly one of the key focus areas where we'll see many interesting things. It's also, you know, society or Washington or not everyone, you know, is rolling their eyes. It's too big in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But cities, that's small enough. And kind of, and the cool thing about cities is that, you know, all the big economic problems we have basically are all problems of the commons, right? That's kind of where capitalism, kind of the current capitalism, isn't really working. And so the problem is if I can't see the commons, but in cities, the commons are right in your face. You see what the problem is much more easily than when it happens on the other side of the planet. And that's where this organizing around kind of ecosystem awareness is so much more easy, because the leverage point for systemic change is seeing the problem first and foremost. Otherwise, we are just pontificating, and kind of the seeing these vehicles for co-sensing the situation, that's so much more easily done in cities. So I think that's why we'll see a lot of interesting things happening, not only on the regeneration of the local economy, as we already see many places around the world, including the U.S., but also kind of the redesign and the recreation of cities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Otto. I was just wondering one more thing. This has been fascinating, and I was just wondering if there is something we as a community, the service-based community, can do to support your work.
That's a fantastic question. So
I'll be definitely posting the links and that you will send me for about the conference and the event happening in Vermont. But I was just wondering, apart from that, if there is something we could do.
I'm sure, but I needed to think a little bit about that. And so where I see a great possibility is in having this. So we started this ULAB as an online course. But when you look at the result, it has been really birthing a global community of change makers. And I think that's where the service space is an example. You know, the whole, basically everything we try to do in, you know, evolving the logic of the economy is towards giftivism, really, kind of on the finance side, on the activity side, really, sparking entrepreneurship and kind of and collective creativity that's driven by that awareness. And I think that's where you guys have not only great stories and examples, but also kind of the way you organize yourself could be so beneficial, so inspiring for people to learn from and maybe also to connect with each other. Mm-hmm. So moving forward, as we evolve the curriculum, I think it could play a much bigger role. And we also will have like an advanced version of the ULAB, and that's exactly where we could go much more deeply in concrete examples. The introductory ULAB was really just the beginning, and you know, as we deepen some of these examples, I think there's a lot of possibility where we really can align and link the movement and the movements and make them, collaborate in the context of the larger whole that we and the larger movement we all belong to.
Thank you. That's wonderful. We'll definitely stay in touch, and Somic will be in touch. So, yeah, feel free to send us ideas as they come. So thanks again, and I'm going to hand over to Somic before we close the call. Somic?
Yes, thank you so much. This has been most edifying, and I learned a lot today. I would, as a way of offering our gratitude, I'm going to read some writings of Otto, which is a good note to end on. And it sort of highlights for me the compassion that I hear from his work, in particular, you know, the space of non-judgment that people who don't have the awareness or for some reason are unable to act on their awareness
I was struck by what he has written about how to deal with that. And this is from his book on Theory U. By the way, for those of you who are wondering, the reason the name U comes in is because the framework is depicted in a U-shaped pattern. So you go deepening on the left side of the bar, going really deep at the base of the U, and then you're emerging, and that's the right side of the U. So it's a very fascinating visualization. And the passage comes from the chapter called Prototyping, which would be of interest, and this is freely available on Otto's website, and I highly recommend it for many people who have interests in ideation and innovation. So I'll start to quote, acting from the future, sensing the feeling drawn to something, moving into that space, acting from the now, crystallizing what emerges from there, prototyping the new, delivering it into reality can take years. Social innovators and innovators in business claim that it took them up to 5, 6, or 7 years before moving from a felt sense, feeling drawn to doing something, to crossing the threshold and beginning their journey of discovery and creation. But you also have to be prepared to act fast. If it takes longer, the important point is not to harshly judge yourself just because you have been sitting with an idea for many years. Only one thing really matters: what you do in the very next moment, now. All the other decision points that are already behind us, all the should-haves and could-haves, no longer matter in any real way. Mm. With that, I'd like to thank Otto again.
Thank you so much, Samik. That was profound. And so at the count of three, I'm going to unmute everyone, and maybe we can all shout out a collective thank you to Otto. 1, 3. Thank you, Otto.
Thank you, Otto.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you,
Otto.
Thank you, everyone.